Voices Radio Network.
Welcome to Strength Depositions Podcast. I'm sitting here. Usually we tend to broadcast from the gym, the Strength Depot gym in Plymouth, Michigan, but we're taking a change today. We're actually broadcasting from actually my house. So we're sitting here with probably my greatest influence in strength, Dan John. So Dan, thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, this worked out really well. I'm glad you were able to, you know, kind of get me in the schedule so quickly, because it starts to pile up sometimes.
Oh, I'm sure. You said that you have several interviews tomorrow lined up as well via Skype?
Yeah, I think, I got one with Europe, so it's a really early morning one, and then one in the afternoon, which, you know, that's it kind of ebbs and flows. It's like the tide a little bit. It just keeps, I seem to get 10 in a week, then none, 20, none for 2 weeks. It just, and so I'm always happy to do it. I think it's, I like this format. I was talking to Laree Draper yesterday. She's my publisher yesterday. I was telling her how much easier it is for me to have a conversation than it is to say sometimes look into a tape recorder and just off the top of your head talk. I find it extraordinarily difficult to do it. I like the give and take.
How many podcasts would you say you've done, Dan? I mean, is there any way you can even put a number on it?
Well, I think just the Kevin Larrabee Spitcast has got to be 15. At least, if not more. I would say, you know, it would be honestly probably sneaking up on 100. If we found them all, that's the hard thing. A lot of them kind of come and go, you know, they, and a lot of them are very small ones. You know, I have talked to a couple people. I did a podcast for someone who specializes with blind athletes and blind exercise people. And, that one wouldn't get a lot of ground, but I sure enjoyed it. And sometimes it's with friends I have, and those are more fun, you know, because you have all those stupid stories and the insights. But yeah, a lot, yeah.
Well, that's awesome. Well, like I said, we really appreciate you doing this one. Strength Deposition started as a small podcast. We were told that we might just want to be a powerlifting strongman type of podcast. Well, we thought about it, and then we kind of didn't want to be pigeonholed into that, just that genre. So Strength Depositions is basically about strength of mind, body, and soul. So we have some Special Olympic athletes that we have on. We have Detroit. I'm based in Michigan. So in Detroit, we do a powerlifting meet every year called Relentless. I know they have one in Minnesota too. Are you familiar with it?
No.
Okay. What it is usually in Minnesota, and in Detroit, there's terminally ill kids in the area, and the terminally ill kids, they need help. The parents need help. And so what we do is we put on a powerlifting meet every year. Usually it's by Kirby Church, and we try and raise money for kids that are terminally ill. And the nice thing about it is what you see the kids there, you see the families there. They end up coming to the powerlifting meet, and you get to interact with them. And if you've ever been to a powerlifting meet, it's great. But to go to a powerlifting meet to see these kids that are just stronger than, you know, you and I'll ever be, all the obstacles that they've had to overcome, it's probably one of the greatest experiences of my life.
I'm glad to hear
it. Yeah.
That's a good thing.
I think so too. So, but that's kind of how we started the podcast. So I can't tell you how much I appreciate, like, you coming on. This means a lot to me personally, to me. So, so Dan, you have a you were talking about Lori Draper. You have your publishing company is OTP, correct?
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So a lot of times, like online, I've seen like Lori will have like an and she'll have like a you know, just a small excerpt of something that you're doing. But you do a Wandering Waits on there, correct?
Yeah.
How did that get started?
Well, you know, it's funny because Larry and I, I like doing this kind of thing. I like the writing. I'm online a lot, looking, you know, looking at research, looking at articles, looking at blogs. And we were just kind of talking about we needed to do, it'd be nice if OTP had some kind of weekly newsletter. And my thought was, well, you know, doing original content every week, like a blog. I have a blog that comes out every Monday, but it's a ton of work. And you know what's funny is a lot of people, you really run out of things to say after a while. You know, lift weights, go for a walk, eat like an adult, get some sleep. I mean, that's okay. I'm pretty much done with the year right there. But the two of us just discussing this. We were in Santa Cruz. I think I was there for an RKC. I was teaching kettlebells. And we just discussed, I think it was her who said, why don't you just talk about what you're reading? And, well, I mean, that just really hit me in the head. At first, I was thinking about just books that I'm reading right now. And, you know, I read a lot of books, absolutely. But that wouldn't carry over into the online format, if you follow, Charles. It would be great that I'm reading a book, but all we could then do is maybe have a link to a bookseller. And that's not really something I wanted to do. So the idea was, well, the stuff I'm reading online. And from the beginning, I've tried real hard to make sure that we had things like from the world of chess, the world of checkers,
right.
American football. Yes, weightlifting. Yes, nutrition. Yes, sleep. Yes, this. Yes, that. But also about cultural things that interest me, or even sometimes manners. Just what I'm reading or what I find piques my interest. I've noticed I do a lot of personal finance articles because I feel that finance and weightlifting are almost the exact same path in life. You know, it's little and often over the long haul. And so if a lot of people I know my age who've locked down their fitness also tend to have locked down their finances. So, and their relationships, to be honest with you. So I find myself fascinated by that stuff. And so it just blossomed. Larry will tell you, I don't remember what number. I want to say we got to be sneaking into the deep hundreds now, I think.
Yep.
But I've never missed one. No matter how much I travel, I always try to make sure I get it to her. I try to, on Monday, I try to finish it up so it can be up without giving her a lot of work, so it can come out on Wednesday. But sometimes when I travel, I'll get it done Thursday or Friday before I take especially a hard and fast European road trip where there's no way I know if I'll even get to internet in time to send away. But I think it's a different approach to a weekly newsletter. Now, I know a lot of people do it with just fitness, but I strive to be a little bit more eclectic than that.
You know, it's funny, too, because, like, even when you speak about training, you're very eclectic even when it comes to training because, right. Like, you've talked about, you know, like, doing kettlebells, and then you've done CrossFit in the past, and you've done Velocity Diet, and you've done all sorts of different genres of training. And where did that come from, Dan? Like, how does that stem from? First off, I just want to say Wandering Weights is wonderful. I absolutely adore it, and I probably get more information off of that, I guess, in general information about life than I do about, you know, training.
Yeah.
But how did that, like, eclectic kind of collecting things for training come together, too? Because it seems, like I said, you'll try anything. And I've heard you say several times, everything works for 6 weeks, but then, you know, something else goes on. You have to adapt. Your body adapts. But how did you get that whole idea of training and just taking things? Because everybody seems to get stuck in the rut of, you know, strictly powerlifting or Highland Games or whatnot.
Well, I've been lifting since 1965, so.
Okay.
That's a long 6-week period. But one thing out of college, I don't do PEDs. So mm-hmm. I've always been looking for the edge. So when I was in the ninth grade, first starting to throw the discus, basically in ninth grade track and field, the discus is a standing throw event. But I knew that the good ones all turned. So I basically taught myself how to do the turn. So I was able to compete with larger, more mature, compete and beat larger and more mature throwers in the ninth grade because I had the ledge. Well, sophomore, junior, they learned to turn. But while they were wearing Converse All-Stars, I was wearing Adidas discus throwing shoes.
Okay.
When they finally, I started lifting weights long before they did. When they started lifting weights, I started Olympic lifting. So I'm always trying to find the next wave, like a surfer does. I'm always looking for the edge. I'm always out there trying to see things. The two biggest mistakes in my career, of course, would have been the 2 years I spent training on Nautilus and the 2 years with CrossFit. But the nice thing about both of those experiences is negative experiences teach you more, I think, than positive. I have never learned a thing from championships and records. I've learned nothing. My wife Tiffany will sit me down after a loss and we'll just start to talk. And she says, write that down. And there'll be a list of 27 things I did wrong, either emotional, preparation, the plane flight. I didn't make a good hotel reservation. I chose poorly. Instead of getting this kind of rented car, I went cheap. I went cheap on this. I should have showed up 2 days early instead of 1 day early. What was I thinking eating this kind of food? And it's funny because all of a sudden you'll look at this chart and you'll see all these things out. Now, if I win on my last throw and make 50 mistakes, I'll just pat myself on the back and say, oh, what a wonderful child I am. So you don't learn very much from success. I know that sounds a little – probably – it's probably close to a definition of insanity. But the thing is you have to – You have to try things. You have to when you read something, if it makes sense, you should try it. Now, I've cleaned it up miles since the old Wild West days I used to do when I would just leap from thing to thing. Mm-hmm. Now I have what I consider a system, and so when I add something new, I make an intelligent discussion with my friend Mike Brown, and we talk about what we're going to drop out. If we add this, what are we going to get rid of? And I got to tell you, that's a huge thing. So if it's if when we added kettlebells, especially the HKC moves, that'd be the goblet squat, the swing, the Turkish getup. Mm-hmm. When we added kettlebells, well, something had to come out. When we got the hip thrust machine, well, how many hinge movements do we need in a workout? So that allowed us to kind of shift and move in a bit of a different direction there. So you can drop certain things out. I don't know if you know my basic thing called the killer apps. What I try to do with every piece of equipment, for example, is find what is the very best thing I can do with this piece of equipment. Can I go on about this? Do you mind a few seconds?
No, please.
So for like the barbell, it's the press family and the deadlift family and probably some squatting, though, that's okay. With kettlebells, no question. Swing, goblet squat, Turkish get. With the TRX and the suspension family, it's the double row, the single arm row, the T, the Y, the I. With the ab wheel, it's the ab wheel. So what I kind of just gave you is a basic program that you can do with very few pieces of equipment. So if someone shows up with a device like when Brett Contreras sent me that wonderful hip thrust machine,
right?
It was great, but at the same time, I had to sit back and go, we're doing a lot of hinging. How will this help us with our hinge family? And it did, and that allowed me to move to what I'll be doing in Chicago. You'll see my movement matrix, and you'll see that in the hinge family, it's. Which, by the way, the hinge family and loaded carries is what builds the athlete. If you can hinge and you can do hinge for explosion, loaded carries for work capacity, if you have those things locked down, generally you're going to be pretty good. So it's okay. So my getting back to my point, when we added the hip thrust, it opened the door to this discussion about, is it okay to have more hinges? Well, and then of course the obvious answer was, look at most sports, and most sports are hinging movements. So, and then if someone shows up with a heavy bag, and we're going to do loaded carries with a heavy bag, wait a second, is it okay to do more loaded carries? Well, yeah, because they build work capacity no matter how you do them. Just keep adding new variations to keep your brain fresh.
Right.
Ah, okay. So what you're saying is that in the hinge and loaded carry family, the more the merrier. But in the push and the pull and the squat family, you need to really, you know, you need to really cut things down a bit. So having said all of that, now something new and pretty comes along. I plug it into that mental matrix I just poorly gave you right now. I'll do a better job. I'll do a better job in the workshops. But the idea is I plug in this new exercise, this new training device into the matrix. If it's good enough to knock something out, well, we'll knock it out. And boy, that so that's a that's where I'm at now. Of course, you know, you call me in 3 years, and I'll say, oh no, 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 that I'm completely wrong. It's all about this new training program, you know, leaper size or whatever it be, you know. But basically, now that I'm a little bit more comfortable with this system, the way I look at systems, the better I feel.
So, Dan, is there something that specifically that you're training for at this point, or is it just general overall strength? Is that like for you?
Yeah, I'm 60.
Okay.
So this weekend I competed in Highland Games.
Okay.
And you know, I'll tell you my number one overall goal. I have a granddaughter named Josie, and she's three. She just turned three. A grandson named Danny, he's four. And I'm making a commitment to dance at her wedding. Uh-huh. So the number one thing would be dance at Josie's wedding. I'm figuring I'll be probably 80 in the 80 range then. The next thing is I would like to compete again. I would like to throw the discus again. If you know, the funny thing is, Masters track meets bother me so much for certain things, but I love throwing the discus. It is something I've always loved, so I can see myself throwing the discus. And having said all this, I still enjoy just swinging kettlebells with people and doing working out with people and training. So I train every day at 9:30, and it kind of depends on who shows up. But as long as I'm training every day, literally every day, and of course I have, you know, I vary things, I change things up, you know. But as long as I'm working out every day, I'm pretty happy. I'm kind of like my dog, you know. If I take him for a walk, he's pretty happy for that 1 hour workout. So yes, I do have long term goals. I'm just not sure of the athletic ones anymore. Okay.
Okay. Well, because you always hear about like. Okay, so I'm training for powerlifting, so I've got to do my big three lifts, and that's it. Or I'm training for strongman, so I need to make sure, like, when I do my carries, I do them for a maximum speed, and then I'm going to take a carry, and then I'm going to do a maximum weight.
Right.
Do you manipulate it per what you're training for, obviously? And, like, or is it just, do you continually, like, just continually try new things during, like, your block of training that, let's say you're training for Highland Games? Your block of training that you're doing for that in your programming, will you change up during that, you know, pre-contest block, or will you, you know?
You certainly could, but remember, I have a very radically different view. I have the traditional track and field view of athletic performance. So for me, it's yin-yang, you know. Half the equation, basically, is strength training. The other half is technical work. And I think you get... I'm not sure of too many people who can really handle specific preparation beyond that.
Right.
And I think the knock I have on a lot of people, let me just give you an example of hypertrophy or bodybuilding, okay? The biggest problem I have with most young guys who try to bodybuild is they're not strong enough yet to get the hormonal cascade from the bodybuilding reps and sets. So, three sets of eight, if you're doing three sets of eight in the bench press, with 365 pounds, you will get a hormonal response, okay? Right?
Yep.
Would you agree to that?
Yep.
Your body's going to have a bit of a freak out. 3 sets of 8 with 65 pounds, your body will probably wonder, why are we not just, you know, taking a nice walk around the park?
Right.
The problem most people have with hypertrophy is they're not strong enough to get the benefits of the barbell yet. So what I've noticed is that most people aren't yet strong enough, or they don't have their lifting movements locked in enough to get the benefits of doing anything but what we consider the traditional weightlifting world, Olympic lifts, power lifts, and a handful of the body weight movements and, you know, like the pull-up, chin-up, and things like that. You follow?
I do.
So, you know, if you're a power lifter, that's probably not a good base for a thrower. But if you're a power lifter who does snatches and cleans, yeah, you'll probably be a good, pretty good thrower without really having to get too cute at all. You will be strong and explosive, whatever you want to call it. You will have your grinds and your ballistics locked in. You will have your ability to understand acceleration locked in. So I don't ever get as specific as some, because I just don't feel people, and I'm not being mean, but if you can't bench 4, snatch 250, clean 300, and back squat 450, why are we having this conversation about specificity?
Exactly.
You're not strong enough yet to get anything out of it. Now, once you have, like, those East German guys used to do the bounce benches, supposedly, you know, I won't even say the weights I've heard, because I have a hard time believing it. But, you know, obviously those guys probably need to tweak a few other things in their training.
Wow. I completely understand, too. And then it all harkens back to, like, you know, GPP and how much work capacity do you have, correct? How much you're available to. Like, you know, right. You see the farmers, and the farmers, like, I've talked about it periodically. You see a farmer, and they can outwork almost anybody. And then, you know, I'm trying to do 20 swings from a sledgehammer on a tire, and I'm winded. So.
Right. So, you know, one of my heroes, a guy named Glenn Passy, he was a discus thrower at Utah State University, won the national championships. Here's the interesting thing. He and I threw the exact same distance in college. Why is that interesting? Because I weighed about 220 to 230. He weighed 178.
Wow.
And we both threw 190. But he was a farm boy from just over the border in Idaho who spent his summers throwing hay bales up into a loft and doing farmer walks all day. So when he went in the weight room in the fall, he didn't need to worry about work capacity because he had it. So I have to have my athletes do sled pulls and farmer walks and car pushes and prowlers and all this other stuff to build up the work capacity. So for me, it gets simpler. Every year I think about weightlifting and throw stuff out, it gets simpler and simpler and simpler for me.
So, Dan, do you have, like, when you're training your athletes, like when you're training your and you're building up GPP, do you have a specific, again, back to programming, do you do a specific block of that? Or do you just do it along with, like, you know, a couple times a week, pull a sled, drag a sled, you know, carry a sandbag? How do you do that? How do you program your GPP in?
We do ease off as the season progresses, but then there's that whole problem with Highland Games athletes where the season lasts 9 months.
Okay.
With Olympic lifters, we just kind of ease up for 2 weeks, like Dave Turner believes. You just kind of have 2 light weeks before me. Now, I'm not into this. So, okay, real quick. It's from my book Now What, but, okay, how long do you want me to go into this, okay?
Okay.
How long?
How long? We're 20 minutes into this.
But how long do you want me to explain this to you?
However long you want to, Dan. I have time, and I'd love to hear whatever you want to explain.
Okay, so what most people miss is they don't understand 4 words. And the words are health, longevity, fitness, and performance. I use Matthew Tone's definition of health, the optimal interplay of the human organs, which means if your liver is doing its job, the pancreas is doing its job, you don't have cancer, you don't have disease, there's no marker showing up, you're healthy. If your teeth are, you know, not dying on, you know, on the root, you're healthy. And you have something growing and, you know, you're healthy. Longevity, I use Rob Wolf's definition, live long, drop dead. I mean, for me, my longevity goal is to dance at Joe's Bible. Fitness is the one that kills all you people, because fitness is ability to do a task. And that's all it means. If you run a marathon and you got brain cancer, you're fit to run a marathon, but you're not healthy.
Right.
There's this little word called performance. It's when they call your name, you step in, and you take care of business. You perform. The problem I see in what most people talk about is they have all these peaks, they have all these plans, they have all these programs, and when they call their name, they poop down their legs and they cannot perform. So I don't want to hear about this perfect peak that you're doing, because all I want to hear is, did you beat your lifetime best? Did you beat your opponent? Did you win? Did you get your goals? Whatever matrix you want, yes or no. And if you say no, all that planning you did was a waste of our time. Now, so as we work into the squadron, if you're doing something once or twice in the world of fitness and longevity, I call that shark habits. So when you call up and make a dental appointment, or you, for me, I just said, yes, I'll see you in 6 months. that's a shark habit. When you floss your teeth like I do whenever you drive, shark habit. When you, there's millions of them that. If you have a shopping list and a menu, shark habit. And then for things that you do ongoing in the field of longevity and fitness, I use a Pat Flynn term, pirate maps. It's a bullet point list of about 5 to 8 things. Here's mine. After a certain time every night, I put on my blue blocking glasses. I take my vitamin D. I take my magnesium in the form of a thing called Calm. I take my fish oil, and I start tooling down for the night. I try not to watch a lot of tea. I try a hot tub every night before I go to bed and take an ice shower, because that turns so I get a good night's sleep. I have already made the coffee, so when I wake up in the morning, very first thing I do is I drink a cup of coffee. And I take care of my emails that came in overnight. If I open an email, as you know, Charles, do I answer it?
You do. You do.
Call it, right? You know that. So yep. Open a piece of mail. Now, that's great. So those are shark habits, but shark habits and pirate maps play good. Now, in the area of fitness and performance, if you're doing something once or twice, that's a program. I've done the Soviet squat program. Once. Of the velocity diet. Once. So most people want programs. Most people want plans. But really, that's like 1 or 2 months a year. What are you doing the rest of the time? Because that's where you build champions, is the rest of the time. And of course, ongoing for performance or fitness, the phrase I use is principles. So I'm a principle-based coach. Not a program-based coach.
Okay.
The principle that we use in football is from 1931. John Heisman, he said, block, tackle, and fall on the ball. Okay. The principle I use for discus throwing is what Coach Mon told me in 1977. Lift weights 3 days a week, throw 4 for the next 8 years, and you'll be pretty good. Most people miss that last part, the 8 years. And in fact, I can even simplify it even more. Throwers throw, jumpers jump, sprinters sprint. That's the principle. And if you get away from throwers throw, well, and you're doing curls. Why are you doing curls? Oh, because I want to look good on the beach. Okay, that's not going to happen. Throwers throw. Okay? So my vision of things, Charles, is not radically different, because when I talk to elite coaches, when I teach over at St. Mary's and University of Twickenham, London, when I talk to the best of the best, they all kind of nod and go, yeah. And everybody agrees. They look at these programs that most people do, And like Dave Tate said one time, he could barely even get through line one of most people's programs because they're so full of crap.
Right.
It's just a bunch of stuff thrown on a piece of paper. Or worse, what I see at most colleges, they cut and paste other people's stuff so that you're doing your, well, real quick, here's the overriding thing if you want to be great. The man who chases two rabbits goes home hungry. So when I look at a training program, the first thing I ask the person is, how many rabbits are you chasing? I think you can chase maybe two at a time if the two are something like strength and flexibility, if the two are hypertrophy and mobility. But after that, it gets real tough to change. I think you can do an appropriate amount of Olympic lifting and train the throws. But boy, I was never able to figure out that combination for myself. My breakthrough year was when I was 47 years old, and I still did some Olympic lifting, but just tastes of it. But my real training was the massive loaded carries that I did. And I went out and had the best season of my life at age 47. Jeez. To some of your listeners, I go, what is he talking about? Trust me, it's unusual.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So how do you think, like, I have two questions as like a, just real two questions to what you were saying.
Sure.
Do you go by, like, let's say your athletes or you, do you go by how you feel during that day? So if you...
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Yeah. Okay. You have to.
Okay.
So that's the problem with a program, which I put... So a program is something you do once or twice a year at most for fitness and performance. If the program calls for six sets of six in the front squat with 80% of your max, which is part of the Soviet squat program, you better feel pretty good that day.
Right.
Well, and that's the problem. A guy like myself, I will push myself through because that's what the squiggly line on a piece of paper says. And long term, it doesn't always help you. So you've got to have – now, it doesn't mean – It's a balancing act here, okay? It's a balancing act. I would rather you save your nervous energy and your potential for performance when they call your name and you step in. I expect those marks in the meets, on the field, to be the best performances you do. How many people do you know leave it all in the weight room? Ed Cohn, the great powerlifter, people used to always say, oh, you were good for two more. And they would just look at him like, yeah, well, I got the world coming out in 6 weeks. I'm not going to show off here in the weight room to impress you. I got the world. And then the world would come around and he'd impress everybody for generations, okay?
So train to your goal.
Train to your goal.
Right.
Now, you have to be careful. Now, I mean, we know this, and it's a whole part of my thing called the art of coaching. I know that, you know, if you break up with your girlfriend, you had a bad night's sleep because your baby kept you awake, you ate at the wrong place and had diarrhea all night. We all know that those will impact your training. But you also have to go in sometimes. Now, yes, too. Dick Notmer, I was real good about this. I'd come in and be, Dick, I'm exhausted. I mean, we had finals. And he would say, well, just warm up and see how you feel. And sometimes that got the engine going. But every injury I have is from a training, well, except for one, two. One from football, one from a miss in weightlifting. It's from trying to go over and above in a training session what I should be doing. Trying to make myself do more than I should have that day in the training session.
Okay. Have you ever been injured during your event? Have you ever?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, broke my wrist in an Olympic lifting meet. Yeah.
Okay. Which you can't help that. That's something you can't train for.
It was actually, if you see the film, it was just when I missed the lift, hit the ground, my elbow hit the ground, and then the bar came back into my hand, so to speak, and blew my wrist apart into about a lot of pieces. And then in football, we were playing a team called Balboa on our own. Field that was probably, I mean, one step harder than asphalt. I made a tackle and we came down on my elbow and I broke four pieces off the end of my elbow. But after that, no, it's mostly training, man.
Okay. You were saying about carries, how you feel that the loaded carries helped you, you know, have the best year of your career.
Right.
How did the loaded carries do that? I mean, in strongman, we do a lot of loaded carries.
And
we feel more athletic from it, and we feel like our work capacity goes up from it. Our grip gets better, our traps get better, our shoulders get stronger, our core gets tighter. We're learning how to actually load our spine safely. So I'm assuming that's why, huh?
So, Charles, think about the sentence you just said.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. It's one of those questions where I want to reach into the audience and strangle the person. Dan, how do you know loaded carries work? Well, I did them and I got better. Oh, well, should I do them? Yes, I think you should. Why? Well, I did them and I got better. Well, you think I should? Yes. Well, what you just gave me was a brilliant explanation of why loaded carries change you. Well, all I have to say is yes, all the above. And the other thing that really helped me was it taught me, so we do this one where you have a heavy backpack on, you're carrying either farmer bars or a big bag, and you're dragging a sled all at the same time. They're called juggernauts from the Marvel comic guy, okay?
Right.
Or the ship from 100 years ago. So 100-pound bag, then you 70-pound backpack, and you're dragging a sled. Well, as I'm dragging the sled, my legs are working in a way that I've never been able to train them before. I'm reaching forward on the ground and having to pull the ground backwards, okay? Because I can't sprint with this. I have to walk in a totally, radically different way I ever had before. It oddly feels like your legs feel enthroned. And I got to tell you, man, for me, and you're right, the posture thing, that area between your knees and your neck we call the calm, all the opposite side work, the pulling on the ground, the mental side of it, you know, just getting, when you're putting that backpack on, you know, this thing hits you and you're like, oh no. Now something, you know, so I put the sled on, I put the backpack on, now I pick up a bag. It took me 45 seconds just to get ready to do this stupid thing. And it just really radically changed my life. It all comes, by the way, the loaded carries all come from my wrist being broken in Olympic lifting meet. My doctor told me I'd never be able to lift again. And I had been doing loaded carries a little bit, some farmer walks, and yay is me. But since I couldn't grip ever, I couldn't make a fist, I started doing bag carries. And the bag carries build up this thing I call anaconda strength, which is the internal pressure. Bag carries feel like Olympic hammer throwing, Scottish hammer throwing, and caber tossing. Well, when you start doing bag carries with a sled, which I think is the cover of Never Let Go,
right?
All of a sudden, I started throwing really far. I broke my left wrist, fortunately, not my right. I started throwing far with much less work. Front squats with the left arm straight ahead, bag carries because I couldn't make a fist, I just wrapped my arms. All of a sudden, I'm throwing far, I'm going to track meets, and my buddies are like, hey, Dan, you're finally, you know, taking a little bit of the, you know what? Hey, you're taking a little bit of the, you know what I'm saying? So, you know, I'm like, no. Well, what are you doing in training? I pick up a bag and I carry it around. No, seriously, what are you doing in training? I pick up a bag with a sled and carry it around. You know, so I don't know. It worked. Hey, man. You know, as the Greeks told us, don't look a gift horse in the mouth. Oh, wait. It's like a little Trojan War humor. Okay.
I love it. And you know, it's funny because, we work out at a small private gym, and like the carries are the big thing. We just went to the USS Nationals, the Strongman Nationals. Oh, that was in Michigan. And we watched like some amazing athletes do like loaded carries and then sandbag carries. And, you know, just like, you know, I've done it in the gym. I've never, you know, competed as strongman before, but just to feel the pressure in your stomach and the pressure in your gut and on your spine and you can't breathe. It's almost like getting the air squeezed out of you. So
yeah, that's what we call anaconda strength.
I like it.
On stone training, there's three kinds of stone training. There's what we call arrow, and you learn that from deadlifts and planks. That's when you turn your whole body into make it as stiff as you can. Like if I was going to tackle you, that's what I would do. Boom, okay? There's anaconda strength, which you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. And the third kind, who can forget? Oh, armor building. And that'd be like for American football or rugby. And that's when you build up the ability of your skin to take a hit. Yeah.
Wow, it's amazing to see all the different things that you've tried. For people who don't know, Dan has done Highland Games, Dan has done track and field, he's done you've done powerlifting, you've done Olympic weightlifting. I believe you've done strongman too, is that correct?
We did strongman events in Ohio before. I wouldn't say before they became famous, but we did these idiotic invented games. Yes, just about put us all in the hospital. Yeah.
Out of all the events that you've done, I mean, I know like it would be hard to pick something that's your favorite or something that you enjoy doing the most. But is throwing the thing that you enjoy the most?
Yeah, and I would say probably the weight pentathlon. That's the five-event track and field. So that's shot, discus, hammer, 35-pound weight, and javelin. That's probably my favorite, yeah.
Do you think
– I like the thinking. To train for it, I mean, I would go out and train, I kind of try to balance the five events, you know, in the training session. I like the mental side of that, yeah.
How much do you think mental strength comes into play for you and your athletes? As far as for like, you know, like, I mean, how much you have these athletes that are just gifted, genetically gifted athletes, and they don't like, you'll see a lot of them. Things come so easy to them that, you know, it's like they just go through the motions. But then you see an athlete that's maybe not as athletically gifted before, but is just strong mentally and just overcomes and, like, you see that athlete and they grind through everything. How much do you think mental strength comes into play in training and in strength sports?
Well, I've gotten away completely from this concept of mental strength. I move now to, and it's, again, this is in my new book, Now What, the same as that little matrix I told you. But it's what I'm trying to do in the weight room. Hang on, I teach both in the weight room and on the field, so I do both. But what I'm trying to do in the weight room is teach the athlete to deal with three things. One, the physical tension. So a 9 for a deadlift, 1 when you're asleep, 4 when you throw the on a scale of 1 to 10. Mm-hmm. 9 is absolute tension, 1 is asleep. A discus thrower wants to be about 4. A shot putter can be probably as high as 7. In American football, that thing's going to go up and down depending on what you're doing in the play. Tackling, you want absolute tension when you hit the guy. The other side, the next one would be the mental side, which is arousal. Okay, arousal. And with arousal, and people giggle because it's the same concept as sex, and I always run down that road with them. Okay, let's talk about sex. You know, if you have too much arousal, you know, if you don't have enough, well, you know, have the right amount of arousal. And so for a discus thrower, the Olympic snatch demands the same level of arousal as a discus throw. Oddly, the clean and jerk and the shot put about the same level of arousal. You need a lot of arousal to clean and jerk. In American football, when I coach American football players, I like to do, I wouldn't call it circuit training because it's a little different, but you know, you would do front squat, a set of front squat, slide over bench press, hurdle walkovers, a tumbling run, and then power snatches. Back to the front squat, back to the bench press. You just would loop through that because that demands that your arousal level slide up and down. Your focus level slide up and down. Your tension level slide up and down. And that's what the game of football is like. So on the mental side, I've really gotten myself away from, you know, I think I can, I think I can, I think I can, I think I can. And even in some cases, I mean, everybody knows the goal, but we go through it anyway.
Right.
But after that, I focus on, are you at the right level of tension? Are you at the right level of arousal? How can we teach you to lower or raise your tension when necessary? How can we teach you to lower or raise your arousal when necessary? And then the third one is heart rate. You know, try to find out as best you can at what heart rate is that athlete competing at the best. You know, maybe, you know, you might have a discus thrower who's calmed themselves down because they had such a, you know, I hate that. Let's give a good classic example of Dan Jansen at the Olympics. So he found out his sister died that morning, and the mark gets set go, and of course he crashes going into the first turn.
Right.
And we use that story all the time in I did grief therapy for a long time. In grief therapy, we use that story. If he would have gotten the gold medal, which would have been wonderful and great and wonderful and great, but at the same time, he would have told the world that being in grief makes you do things great. Well, in truth, being in grief makes you do things. You stumble around in true grief for a while. So if your arousal is too high, I'm going to teach you to bring it down a little bit. If the whole world wants you to win because your sister died that morning, you need to calm down instead of gear up. With your heart rate, I told him to calm down. His heart rate, now we got him, we had him meditate, we had him put on his magic socks, we had you chew the gum that makes you feel most worthy. But your heart rate's at 72, where you're optimally at 90 or 150, we need to have you do jumping jacks or something like that to get your heart rate so that you – so we need to have your tension dialed in, your arousal dialed in, and to be at the right heart rate. And it's funny because you mentioned, you know, body, mind, soul, and spirit earlier. Mm-hmm. And since you're trying to do that same thing with dials, and we do it on purpose. So we practice raising arousal level in training, raising arousal level. You know, I like to step into the discus ring and stop a discus thrower because that happens at track meets. I like to give guys, if we're doing a practice and we're kicking field goals, I like to give the team just one chance. Just one. That's all you get. Because games come down to just one field goal, not, okay, let's try it again. Okay, let's try it again. Okay, let's try it again. And if they fail, they fail. And you lost. Enjoy that. You know, to practice so that the snapper, the holder, and the kicker practice the arousal necessary. I might trade conditioning drills for a made field goal. Well, if 92 people are looking at you to make a field goal, otherwise they have to run 10 100-meter sprints with only 30 seconds rest in between, your arousal level gets way up there. Because when they're running those sprints, they're going to be dropping F-bombs about you the entire time.
All eyes on you, basically.
And so that's what performance is, Charles.
Yeah. You know, it's funny you mention that. It's almost an epiphany because we were talking about a lifter that we have, and he got so psyched for his lift that he psyched himself out of, you know, a great attempt. Yeah, completely. He, you know, he did the ammonia. He did the... you know, like the scream, the primal scream, and then he, you know, tanked it. And it's funny because
happens all the time.
Yeah.
Does he take ammonia at practice?
Yeah, he does it in practice too.
Okay, but I'm just saying. So you're talking. He did this 12-week peaking program.
Yeah.
And when it came time to perform, he failed.
Yes.
So talking about this 12-week peaking program, well, he didn't train arousal, tension, and heart rate.
It's almost like an epiphany because, like, you were talking about it and I was just thinking about this guy. So it's right. Very interesting.
So I get people argue with me on this one all the time. Well, of course peaking programs work. Really? Have you ever looked at the Olympic trials? Because if peaking worked, every single person at the Olympic trials would get a personal record or at least a seasonal best, right?
Absolutely.
And fail miserably. If peaking worked, every powerlifter, because you guys love peaking, it's 9 for 9. So if it works, why is it? Show me the data that proves that it works. And every single experienced person I know will say to me, well, I'll tell you why it didn't work this time. Okay, why? Well, when I was getting ready for the lift, I heard someone coughing. Oh, so Oh, so you have to have a 12-week coughing protocol now? I was getting ready, but they put a guy right before me, so instead of having 4 minutes, I had 6 minutes. In other words, you don't know how to perform.
Right.
Well, no. You're following what I'm trying to say. Am I against peaking, planning, and programming? Not necessarily, except it rarely works. Because unless you're performing, all you're doing is a bunch of workouts. And I got nothing against workouts. But you got to understand that there's a difference between performing and having this little plan that didn't work. And so what you need to do every time, do you sit down after every competition and say what worked, what didn't, what mistakes did I make? Do you write them down in a journal? Do you sit down with someone you trust and say, I screwed up here, here, and here? I won a national championship. I showed up. I didn't have my membership card. I had my wife's. And they weren't going to let me lift. And the one judge says, don't worry about it. We have your number. And the one guy became an asshole. And the other guy just kind of – so I was freaked out because I had brought the wrong membership card. So it affected my snatches big time. And then when it came time to clean and jerk, I was going to try to make up a lot of ground. My wife, Tiffany, said to me, don't you have a plan? And I said, yeah. She goes, why don't you stick to the plan for the first two lifts? And everybody wondered why I wasn't going heavier on clean jerks to make up the lost ground. And the idea was, let's get two successful clean and jerks and then win or die on the last one. And it worked out perfect. So even in the middle of competition, sometimes you got to sit back and go, what was the plan again? I've been down 14-0 as a football coach with about a minute and a half off the clock. We kicked off. They took the opening kickoff, ran it all the way back. Son of a bitch. We take the snap. Kid fumbles. They take the ball. Next play, score. They miss the extra point. 13-0. So you gather your team and say, we have to be out here another hour or two. Do you guys want to play now? Right?
Right.
We beat that team 14-13.
You know, it's funny, like, you know, you talk about arousal and whatnot. It's like, it's almost like you see a pro fighter. Like, if you see a pro fighter and you see somebody that, like, if a pro fighter fights against somebody who is not trained and just swinging wildly, chances are 10 out of 10 times they lose. I mean, 9 out of 10 because they're going to get a lucky punch in maybe. But you always see usually like the fighter being very calm, very, you know, like methodical, sticking to their plan. And you see that a lot in sports. Like you see people get amped up, too amped up. Like you say, arousal, too high of a arousal and not do well at all.
Oh, all the time.
Yeah.
Because it's like you'll notice one thing when they do that idiotic thing before NFL games, all that hooping and hollering at the camera. Next time you see that, write down the numbers of the players who are doing that. Very rarely will you see starters. And if you do, watch if it's like a quarterback, they're putting up what the quarterback needs to do is shut down because you can't have high arousal and wide to narrow, narrow to wide focus. You just can't do it. So if you're in fight or flight, you tell your body fight or flight, you're either sprinting as fast as you can away from something or turning to take on. You can't make micro to macro decisions there. So you'll notice they're rarely. I don't ever see starters doing that. Right. In fact, it's idiocy if you don't mind.
Well, we saw, like, you know, in Detroit, we had Barry Sanders here. And
right.
So you never saw Barry Sanders get too high or too low, just did his job. So that's kind of how I think of it. Joe Dumars, Steve Eiserman, same type of thing.
Yeah, see, Barry Sanders is a phenomenal guy because don't forget how he trained. He ran hills and did power cleans. That was his training. So sprints and power cleans, and to be honest, if you look at the position of running back, it's hill sprints. So it's hill sprints because that's the way you have to run as a running back. You know, you're driving. And then power cleans because you got to be able to pop somebody when you block it. So he nailed the matrix of running back perfectly. I always try to convince my running back to do that. and yet they spend all their time doing curls and reverse curls and skull crush. And working their abs, for God's sakes.
Yeah, it's funny. You see, like, a lot of people work their abs and whatnot, and then, you know, they'll do the crunches, and, I mean, your abs don't even work that way. So, right. You know, they work with your hips and everything else. So
work abs, do a monster walk with a 100-pound man, right?
We have a strong man that says it all the time. I don't work abs. I just carry heavy shit. So
whoever this guy is, tell him I'm applauding him 100%.
Well, so Dan, like, who are some of your influences in training? Because you have so many varied, like, you know, an eclectic taste in training, and you've collected so many different different information over the years. Who do you look to for information, and who were your inspirations while you were starting?
Let's make that two parts, okay?
Please.
Okay, so my inspiration coming up as an athlete would have been what I read in Strength and Health magazine. I'd read, like, there was a Houston Oilers linebacker named Ron Pritchard. So for football, I'd try to do what he kind of did. I would read articles about, like, guys like Al Fuhrbach, Brian Oldfield, who just died, a good friend of mine. And what I would try to do is look to see what they were doing. But fortunately, early in the Strength and Health, I read an article by Pat O'Shea, that famous Oregon State researcher. And I just looked at the program, and it made so much sense to me. Those guys over at Jim Jones based so much of their work on them. But his early articles just were so logical to me that I sort of started trying to learn the lifts correctly following him. When I was in junior high, I learned a very good program that I still talk about called the Southwood program. But really, outside of the Southwood program, reading the stuff on the walls that were made by Universal for the Universal weight machines, it was Strength and Health and the monthly hero that would show up who overcame odds and took his Energol and his high protein and all of life was cured. But from there, I lucked into meeting Dick Notmeyer, my Olympic lifting coach, who, I went to a weightlifting meet, Olympic lifting meet, just to see how to do it. And someone mentioned, thank you to Dick Notmeyer. I recognize his name from Strength and Health. And he charged me 25 cents a week to train in his gym for 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. He taught me just about everything I know about life, just about everything I know about lifting. And then from there, it'd be Ralph Mon at Utah State, who was, of course, that great discus-throwing coach who died July 3rd, 2006. Changed my life. A nod to my junior college coach, Bob Lahati, and my high school coach, Pete Cicchetti. Pete wasn't my actual coach, but he was a very calming resource for me. Once I got out of college, once I started going on my own, that's when I started getting involved with other people, not so much hands-on, though Dave Turner, my local coach here, was tremendous. So beyond college, it'd be Dave Turner, and it'd be all my training partners, John Price, Paul Northway, all the guys who threw with me, okay? John Powell, the great former world record holder in the discus, Brian Oldfield again. But now the people I read, well, you can see it in Wandering Weight, so I kind of focus on it. But when I was in London a couple weeks ago, I read Mike Boyle's new book.
Right.
I'm a big fan of what Mike does. I think Mike and I walk down the same path. What works, what doesn't work, what works, what doesn't work, what works, what doesn't work. In the field, I mean, I got to tell you, Pavel's book, Power of the People, really helped me, though. I already read most of it in that, was it the magazine Muscle, Mind, and Power? I'd read some of it somewhere before. I think his books were fantastic. Nowadays, I get a lot of information from, of course, Stu McGill,
right,
up in Canada. Stu, smart guy, but he also lifts weights, does pull-ups, he deadlifts, he does, you know, suitcase carries. So he's taking what he's learning. Okay, no question, he's a science guy, but he's also listening to what he's learning, on the field of play. I would say Tim Anderson with his original strength, real smart young guy, real up and comer. There's some people on T Nation that I try to read their articles whenever they come up. It just kind of depends. You know, you'll see it. I'll always quote them when I get to Wandering Waits. But, you know, it's a real hodgepodge and mess of things, to be honest with you. It's kind of, sometimes I'll, you know, I just got to tell you, we're back online now. It's, and of course, with the, when people write books now, they're trying to, you know, they're trying to sell instead of just write books.
Everybody's a personal trainer. Everybody's got like a program to sell. Everybody's got, you know, call me for my secret program or whatever. You hear that all the time.
You know, one thing that really helped me. So that had a great awakening, my own 1800s experience. But a few years ago, my buddy Vasily and I were talking, and I was talking about this magazine I was reading and this new book that had come out all about the Soviet strength secrets. And Vasily had this fascinating Soviet accent. Damn. And he basically told me that everything I was reading was a bunch of crap. I go, what? He goes, Don, most of the great lifters in Soviet Union couldn't read this stuff. And I went, what? He goes, yeah, this is all. And he said, bullshit. I go, what? Yes. He goes, this is not true. No one does this. So his training, which he should be able to find on my website. I'm going to have to re-pull that up. But he taught me the real Soviet method, where it was fascinating. And it was like nothing you read. All that meso and macro stuff, none of them did that. None of them did. And I go, no, wait, that can't be true because it was in a magazine. And he's the first person to ever point out to me, because I'm an idiot, that just because it's written doesn't mean it's true. I mean, I can say fake news all day, but, you know, that doesn't make it not true, you know. And I just was shocked. And so Vasily, Dave Turner. So Vasily really liked the way Dave Turner did things, because he said that's much more like we did things for the youth in the Soviet Union, where you take a stick and you spend 20 minutes on a stick, and then a very, I don't know if you know my stuff on Dave Turner, but 8 sets of 2 in the snatch, 8 sets of 1 in the clean and jerk, 5x3 in the press, and 5x3 it lit in the end, in the front squat, all with basically the same weight because you're trying to build the movement. He goes, that's how we did things. And then, you know, focus on the finish, which I found out with the East Germans is also how they train their throwers. Focus on the finish. And I'm just sitting here in this middle of this, and all of a sudden it's like this light bulb came off. And I'm not saying I ever became cynical, because it's not really, I'm not very cynical as a person, but it allowed me to all of a sudden, I looked at my big collection of Bulgarian power secrets, and, you know, this and that and this, and realized what a bunch of hooey I had been fed for so long.
It's, you know, it's almost like, you know, when you were, talking about Mike Boyle and relating it to you, it seems like the both of you have a tendency to take something complicated, make it, cut out all the bullshit, and take the things that work from it, and like you said, get rid of the shit that doesn't. And, like, it seems to be that, you know, like I said, Boyle does the same thing in his new book. He does the same thing. And, I mean, that's kind of what your friend did as far as for Turner with when it comes to, like, you know, basically training for youth.
Exactly. And, you know, it's funny because you'll – when you lay something out like that, you stick to it. Yeah, it's funny. People say I make things simple, and it's like I really don't. You've been fed so much garbage that when I have this little thing that this is what we do. Well, that's simple. Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sorry. It works. That's why we do it. Now, if it didn't work, we would have abandoned it a long time ago. You know, that's a hard thing for people to hear.
Yeah. Yeah, and you see that a lot. You see, like, everybody, like, and again, getting back to, like, all the quote-unquote programming, like, a lot of, you know, athletes do as far as for like bodybuilding and powerlifting and whatnot. They try and make something so complicated. And in essence, it's like Jim Wendler said, you know, pick something up, put it down, lift it from the ground, lift it overhead, push it, pull it, and run some sprints. I mean, that's basically it, right?
I said almost the exact same thing in July 2002. Yeah, it's funny. Okay, yeah, that's just funny, isn't it? Yeah.
I see it a lot too. And you see it a lot in like the beginning lifters too, because they all want to do a million sets of biceps, a million sets of triceps, and they don't want to focus on their hips or, you know, the prime movers.
Well, and let's be honest. What I'm offering you today isn't very sexy, okay?
It's pretty sexy to me, Dan.
Relax a little bit here.
But
I realized that my approach is sometimes I look at my movement matrix when I'm giving a workshop, and I can look, like my students in St. Mary's, and I can look in the audience sometimes, and I can see someone have their face on their cheek on their fist, and they're going blah blah blah. And yet, then I'll see the half or two thirds leaning forward, and going, "That's all I have to do." Oh, thank you. Okay, I can. So in my matrix, I think I have 26 exercises total, and I doubt any athlete would ever do more than 6 or 7 a day.
Right.
And yet, I expect you to master 26 things. People, well, that should be simple. Well, it took me 17 years from my first snatch to my personal record. It took me 17 years of training to get there.
Well, it's funny, like you said. You see all these different movements and all these different machines and whatnot, and then it just kind of all boils down to, you know, picking the weight up, putting it down, carrying something, hinge.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's people try and overcomplicate it, really. So.
Constantly, yes.
So when you met Pavel, did you guys meet in an RKC thing, or did you guys know each other prior?
We met, actually, it's an important story, really. We met at Charles Staley's boot camp. The week before, one of Charles's speakers backed out. And my friend Mike and Mindy, who were training with Charles at the time, said, "Well, God, just get Dan John down here. He could speak for an hour." And Charles Staley famously said, "Who's Dan John?" And they were both shocked that he had never heard of me, because in our weird world, you know, a throwing, I'm kind of famous.
Yeah.
And he invited me up. He gave me an hour to speak. This is when my career took off, because when Chris Schubert of T-Nation was at the event and he wrote a review of the event, he said, "If you ever get a chance to hear Dan John speak, you must go no matter where it is." Well, again, no one had ever heard of me. And then out of nowhere, you know, a few years later, it was a turning point in my career. So Pavel spoke right after me, and the two of us speak the exact same language. And so afterwards, Pavel and I had a conversation about tension and relaxation, and we talked about how I use isometrics to teach technique, not just strength, but technique, which is kind of unusual. And then he talked to me about the importance of being sure I bleed off all that tension before the athlete then does the full movement. So you find a position in the discus, for example, we call it the pre-throwing strike 3B. So I put an athlete in the 3B position. I make sure their heels in the right place, their knees pointing where it should be, the left foot's, you know, in the position it's supposed to be, left arm's in the hip position, right hand's long. And then we do an isometric contraction where I might even slap different body parts. Then they shake it off, get in the ring and do a full throw. And oddly, that moment of isometric teaches the appropriate place to be technically, which you wouldn't think, but it's true.
Okay.
And so the two of us really hit it off very well. He's the one that convinced me to do easy strength to prepare for 2003 and 2004. So in 2003 and 2004, outside of loaded carries, in fact, he probably included, I don't think I had a weight workout that lasted more than 12 to 15 minutes.
Jeez.
Yeah, but here's the problem. I threw the best of my life, so how could that possibly work?
Yeah. Again, performance, right?
This is why it's so important to hear me. Now, I should have stayed in the weight room longer to work my greater, you know.
Whatever, yeah.
Or to take care of it. So get out. You're done. You know, you're done. You took care of strength. You took care of work capacity. Now get out. Well, what should you do? Well, you can either go throw some more, practice the isometrics. I used to practice my throw isometrically in my garage and shake things out. And the number of throws I had, instead of 1,000 throws a month, I was down to maybe 200, 250, but throwing farther because I was doing more technical work, appropriate technical work. I just tell you, it's – but, and this is a tough thing, you have to be in a place in your life, which is age 45, 46, 47, where you're willing to try. And most people aren't.
I think because everybody wants something like – everybody thinks more is always better.
More is more. That's yeah. All.
Yeah. I know Pavel does – he. I mean, I know you do. You teach RKC hard style, don't you?
Sure, of course.
Okay. Like, I had never figured out how to do a kettlebell swing until I had learned that hard style, and it was from you, actually. In one of your videos, I believe it was a Utah workshop, you were talking about, in order to do a proper kettlebell swing, you hike the kettlebell towards your junk. And one of two things is going to do. You're either going to get hit, and you're just a tough SOB, or you're going to get out of the way. And yeah. The reversal and the ballistic strength. Yep.
That's a big part of it, yeah.
But I remember when I teach people about it, I teach people about ballistics, and we talk about how there's nothing slow in sport. Like, everything is done in a ballistic style, so why would you train slow? And, like, I tell a lot of people that, and because everybody wants to do, like, you know, 3 seconds up, 3 seconds down. I mean, I can understand, like, loading up the eccentrics, that's fine, or the eccentric, but I don't know why you would want to be slow in your concentric. So maybe I don't get that. So
yeah.
But Dan, I'm gonna wrap this up because I know that your time is very, very, you know, valuable. And honestly, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you coming on here. When I started this, and again, when I started this podcast with a bunch of my friends, we all wanted to get Dan John on, and that was kind of like the holy grail. So it's a huge honor for me. And I'm really looking forward to meeting you in the Chicago seminar as well.
And if you ever want to follow up on this, just let me know. Usually afternoons are very good, okay?
Thank you so much, Dan. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
You bet. Hey, we'll talk again soon, okay?
Please. Thank you very much.
All right, my friend. Talk soon.
Take care, Dan. Thank you.
Voices Radio.